Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And we are here with another special live edition, live recording, this time with NatSec Girl Squad. Cheers to everyone in the house. We have some fabulous guests with us here today. We have Dr. Mara Carlin, Dr. Kim Kagan, and Dana Stroll, and we are going to talk about all kinds of interesting things. But first, many, many thanks to Maggie Feldman-Pilch for launching NatSec Girl Squad, for inviting us here to talk about all things substantive and process-oriented. Thanks to all of you. Apparently, we sold 400 tickets for this event, so that is huge thanks to the individual members of this community, both for making this event happen, but for also building this community and trying to create a more inclusive and sophisticated space in the national security world. And finally, thanks to all the many sponsors who are committed to building and supporting competent diversity and foreign policy in defense. So, with all of that, you all are enjoying your lunches. I regrettably have to admit, Radha, we're not drinking anything.
Well, I mean, I'm drinking coffee.
Right. It's like the middle of the day. I feel like we should be...
We really failed.
We drink at much less appropriate times of the day, usually.
I think Lauren is like possibly drinking a fruity beverage on a beach somewhere.
So yeah, you're going to have to work on that mic discipline. Talk straight forward.
Erin's our resident maintainer of mic discipline.
It's very important.
It is.
As we mentioned, we have three fabulous guests. We did not all select short, dark-haired women for this podcast, but I think that that's a new decision criteria that we may have to implement. Thank you all, ladies, for joining us here. As many of you know, we have on Bombshell a segment we used to call This Is Still a Thing, and this week that thing is Syria. But before we get to that, we're going to do some Bombshell questions, although you guys were kind of picky about which ones you wanted to answer.
Indeed, we were.
Okay,
so opinions.
They're all going to tell you're all going to tell us your favorite fictional or literary hero.
Sure, I'll start. Thank you so much for having us today. It is such a treat. My favorite fictional hero is Hermione Granger because she is bold, brave, and bright.
I am a huge Tolkien fan, and so my favorite fictional hero is Aragorn for his.
Because he's hot?
Yes. For his understanding of his mission, his lifetime commitment to it, his understanding of the need to take risks, and his understanding that success is not certain, not to mention a little faithfulness in love.
Here I was thinking they were going to pick really, really serious literary heroes and stayed up all night perseverating about my literary hero. So mine is Jean Valjean from Les Miserables.
Oh.
Story about redemption, and after making some mistakes in his life, turns his life around and decides to empower and help others.
I'm so sorry that Lauren's not here to sing us, you know, any number of songs now from Les Mis. Those are excellent. I can't believe none of you follow something like a sport that is not a sport. I know that there must be something.
I do. It's just TV shows.
That's a great answer. The whole point. Anyway, fabulous ladies, we contain multitudes. And with that, scene setting aside, we have some more serious topics to delve into.
Yes. So all of our guests here today were part of a congressionally mandated bipartisan commission that focused on Syria, trying to provide an assessment of the political and military state of play, but also to try to provide some recommendations and insight. It also happened to feature gender parity, which was also an amazing and, I think, new first of its kind for a congressionally mandated study group. So maybe you could start off by telling us your favorite or most interesting or most relevant recommendation or finding that came from the study.
So I'll start. What was the most compelling finding to me of the Syria study group is we talked about the fact that the conflict has not ended. There's this tendency in Washington, and really if you go across the Middle East or in the halls of Europe, and people will talk about resignation, the sense that Assad has won. And what the Syria study group member said is that Assad has not won. His regime, backed by Iran and Russia, has made significant battlefield momentum, but that does not mean decisive victory. And in fact, what we're going to see next is just another phase in conflict in Syria.
My favorite or most interesting finding is that actually the war in Syria is not a Middle East regional conflict, but actually part of the global competition for power. And so it's really important not to consider it simply in terms of what's happening on the ground, but to recognize that what's happening on the ground is part of a competition between the United States, Russia, and other competitors.
I was most dismayed by the mission creep and the mission confusion for the U.S. military out in Syria. I mean, I think we had all been nervous about that when we started the commission, but to hear, frankly, totally varying descriptions of why the military was there and what it was supposed to do was profoundly disheartening. It's also really dangerous for the U.S. military and arguably not terribly effective against adversaries or vis-a-vis partners. And given kind of the latest events of the last few weeks, where now suddenly the mission has turned into protecting oil, it's just further validation that confusion in what you are doing somewhere is profoundly problematic.
So I want to come back to that maybe in just a little bit in terms of the more recent events. Dana, I wonder if you can help us step back and tell us a little bit about the commission, the congressional mandate, and how you sort of put some of these pieces and the top talent together to do this study.
Sure. Thanks for that question. So the Syria Study Group was stood up by Congress by an act of legislation. And that legislation to stand up and fund this group took several years and two Congresses. And ultimately, collaboration between the late Senator John McCain and Senator Jean Shaheen of New Hampshire today succeeded in getting that legislation passed at the end of the last Congress. And if people can remember, a year ago, legislation passes, the group is mandated by Congress to stand up, and then we go into a government shutdown. So it took
everybody's favorite.
Yeah, everybody's favorite. Well, that was a really long one. So for the federal government employees in the room right now, we know that was particularly hard for you all. Meanwhile, we were waiting in the Syria Study Group for the government to come back in so that we could start this group. The legislation and Congress asked the members of the group to do two things. One, provide an assessment of the political and the military state of Syria. So both militarily, what's happening in the conflict, what's our military mission, and then the second thing that Congress asked us to do was make recommendations for U.S. policy going forward. And what's significant about is that there was bipartisan support for the commission, and then the way that the group was formed is 12 members of Congress, so 6 Democratic members of Congress, 6 Republican members of Congress, each appointed somebody, an outside expert, to the group. And we ended up with this group, not only, as Radha mentioned, gender parity, so 6 women and 6 men on both sides, so there were some Democratic appointed and some Republican appointed women on both sides. We had former general officers, former ambassadors, former senators, as well as a really impressive cohort of rising national security stars and thinkers. So it was a real cross-spectrum in terms of diversity, experience, gender perspective, et cetera. And what we did for about 6 months is hold a series of meetings where we consulted with the U.S. government, with foreign governments, the United Nations, NGOs, international organizations, Syrians, Syrian Americans, human rights community, humanitarian community. We also traveled to the region for fact-finding missions. We went down to Tampa to talk to U.S. Central Command. And what we were doing is taking in everybody's assessments of both the military and the political state of the conflict, and also debating recommendations and gaining feedback from all these different views and constituencies. In the end, we produced a report which came out in September, and I'll just give you the shortest of headlines about the report. If we can pretend that the past couple months didn't happen and go
can
back
we?
To...
Could we really?
You never can.
I would love to.
I know.
Can we?
Every day I wake up and wish we could pretend that what happened yesterday, 5 hours ago, 30 seconds ago, didn't happen. But that's me. So September 26, our report comes out. And at this point in time, President Trump had already announced twice that U.S. forces were leaving Syria.
And what we found in a lot of our discussions, both with people inside the U.S. government working on Syria policy and those partners and allies in Europe and the Middle East that we want to be working with us on Syria policy, we're finding it incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to plan or make commitments, both in terms of resources, funding, their own military contributions, or their own policy, because they didn't know what the United States policy is, was, or when it was going to change. So what we said in mid-September when the report came out is do not withdraw U.S. military forces from Syria. And we said it for two reasons. The first one is because the fight against ISIS was not complete, and in fact, ISIS was transitioning from a conventional fighting force who used to hold territory to a counterinsurgency force who doesn't hold territory but nevertheless is highly lethal. And two, we said it's not just about the fight against ISIS. It's that the U.S. military, vis-a-vis its partnership with the Syrian Democratic Forces, was holding one-third of Syrian territory. And that one-third of Syrian territory is the economic powerhouse in terms of hydrocarbons, agriculture, etc. So everybody wants it. Russia wants it. Iran wants it. The Assad regime wants it. And so that piece of Syria is enormous political leverage to address the underlying causes of conflict. So through the UN process, we keep hearing about these meetings in Geneva, et cetera, holding that territory for some period of time until there's an opening for a broader political process to address the entire conflict, the great power competition that Kim mentioned, et cetera, that the U.S. leverage in this conflict, given the fact that we are never going, we don't have the political will or the wherewithal to match the resource investment of the Russians or Iranians, what we did have was that one-third of Syria vis-a-vis the SDF. So I'll leave it there. We know what happened a couple of days later. We all woke up. The president had a phone call with Turkish President Erdogan. He announced that U.S. forces were leaving. Turkish military comes into northeastern Syria. U.S. forces appear to be leaving without the planning or the heads up to both consult with allies and partners or deliberately withdraw in a safe way, both for our forces and for the mission. And that confusion sort of continues today, including most recently the Secretary of Defense talking about 600 forces in Syria, as Mara mentioned, protecting the oil, except I haven't heard anybody in the U.S. government talk about the overarching objectives for U.S. policy changing. So we're trying to do the same thing, just with less.
So on the plus side, you got to test some of the theory and empirics on the ground. Maybe in the context of sort of that layout from Dana, do you guys want to give us a sense of what are the recommendations or the things that really stand out to you that the administration should do, like, right now? Like, these are the things we should focus on to at least get the Syria strategy on track.
First and foremost, I think it's very important that the United States, even after this disastrous ceding of leverage and terrain in Syria, actually still has forces on the ground. The United States armed forces are a critical part of maintaining not only the tactical security of oil fields, which are not only piece of physical infrastructure, but actually a very important game piece in the competition between Russia, the Assad regime, Iran, the Kurds, ISIS, the Syrian opposition. And so even in this larger frame where we've drawn down and are trying to hold on, it is important that we're holding on. So my first recommendation is let's stay in Syria, because we have recognized in the past few months how important it is to have forces on the ground to retain leverage in diplomacy. And then secondly, that in fact, Russia, Iran, and the Assad regime are not really 10 feet tall. They do not have the forces, resources, and capabilities necessary to fill the gap that the United States is leaving.
Of course, and those forces who've been there haven't been there in direct confrontation with Iran or Assad, right? They were there as trainers. So, I mean, this sort of gets to both Dana and Mara's question. U.S. forces on the ground, to quote an old grad school friend, for to do what?
So I think that U.S. forces on the ground are part of maintaining our grand strategic leverage and our strategic leverage as the United States in a competition where our rivals and indeed declared enemies are competing for terrain and resources in order to get an upper hand in a diplomatic and military negotiation that can change the balance of power in the world.
I'm going to have a hard time selling that to Lance Corporals, but
sorry.
No, I see exactly what you're saying, Aaron. And if, you know, obviously, I suspect most folks here have been reading all the Afghanistan-related material that's come out in the last few days. And I think it's a really interesting kind of stark contrast to how we think about Syria. Because I often hear folks say Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria as examples of, like, these endless wars, if you will, that we've been in for years and years and years. The U.S. actually hasn't been doing much in Syria. Right? So actually, a not terribly large military presence has been useful in helping our partners hold territory, protect civilians, capture all sorts of, like, nefarious actors. I do think it would be nice for us to have some sort of clarity about the extent to which this matters. And my argument is that while the Middle East is purgatory, Syria, you know, epitomizes how Vegas rules don't apply to that region. So a little bit of effort can actually have an outsized effect, particularly in terms of convening power. As much as we've been utterly precipitous and confusing in 19 different ways, various actors keep turning to us and saying, hey, so what do you want to do? Seems to me we could probably use that convening authority in a more productive way than tweeting out new policies.
Erin, if I could just say that I think that our Lance Corporals have a great deal of respect for the national security of the United States and its overall grand strategic objectives, and that part of the problem that we're having, that I think Mara is identifying, is that we have had a problem with our leadership understanding, articulating, explaining what it is that we are doing in the theater. And so I really think that the tactical missions in which our troops are engaged are incredibly important also to the counter-ISIS fight, but that what we really need here is leadership clarity, which is what it is that Mara has called for.
Dana?
So I think that the 1,000 forces we had in Syria in September were already precarious in terms of not having a clear mission articulated from our nation's national security leaders. And two, one of the things we talk about in the Syria Study Group report is how problematic our relationship with the Syrian Defense Forces, the majority of which are Syrian Kurds, the YPG, has been deeply problematic for our relationship with Turkey and NATO ally. What the United States never did was commit to the Kurds that if they fought ISIS, so that U.S. young men and women wouldn't have to shed our own blood in the fight against ISIS in Syria, that we would deliver them a state in northeastern Syria. That was never a promise. But there was also no vision, political vision, for exactly what would the role of the Syrian Kurds would be. And there also hasn't been any civilian diplomatic component that's been extremely energized and empowered by Washington to actually close a deal in terms of the political process. So whatever the leverage that comes from the U.S. military instrument in northeast Syria in September, in my view, had not been applied appropriately or prioritized and resourced by the decision makers here in Washington to actually achieve an outcome where you could address either the terrorism problem that emanates from Syria or the implications for great power competition with Russia in Syria. And now we're in an even worse situation because we're articulating the same mission, right, defeating ISIS. This situation of protecting the oil, I would argue, is also very problematic for U.S. military forces. We continue to talk about sanctions. We continue to talk about a political process. We continue to talk about Iran getting out of Syria. We continue to talk about Russia changing its behavior in the region. And we're going to do all of that with 600 forces in one very small part of Syria that's not tied into a larger conversation or objective. And meanwhile, we haven't really been honest with either our Turkish NATO allies or with our local Syrian Kurdish partners about exactly what we're doing and how we're going to do it and on what timeline. So I think that's all extremely dangerous, not just for the U.S. military, but for U.S. leadership and standing in the region if we want to do anything in the future going forward.
So let's shift gears just a little bit, and because this is Bombshell and process is our Valentine, if you guys could talk a little bit about how the sausage got made for this commission. We've noted that it was bipartisan. We've noted that there was gender parity. I'm kind of wondering both what it's like to try to make bipartisan foreign policy recommendations in this day and age. I'm also wondering kind of what the gender dynamics and personality dynamics were like on the commission, if at all. So if anyone has, you know, sort of some reflections or observations on this experience, because it strikes me that's a little bit different than, you know, a particular think tank working group or an NSC meeting or something else you might have been engaged with previously.
Yeah, I'll offer two thoughts. So one that was impressive to me was almost all of us came with baggage on this topic. We had worked on it, say, through various administrations. Unsurprisingly, the policies that we had pushed or enacted did not turn out butterflies and unicorns, because this is a really complicated and ugly topic in all sorts of different ways. And I appreciated that we were all able to kind of acknowledge that baggage, but also not be beholden to it. Right, I can't remember any time where someone said, gosh, if only, you know, remember when I said X, Y. I mean, there was a lot of sort of kind of that willingness to be frank in those ways. The other thing I would say is that it is really easy to be irresponsible on a commission. You don't have to implement anything, right? And so if you were hearing what we're saying about our finding and saying, well, that seems kind of unsatisfying and, you know, maybe too nuanced and what have you, I would argue that's actually a good thing. It means that even though we understand that we don't have to implement what was pitched, we were pretty realistic, right? So you don't read our commission report and see there should be 50,000 U.S. troops in Syria, or the U.S. should take the, you know, X or Y role. We were trying to live in the practical, not in the sort of phantasmagorical.
I would add that it isn't actually that difficult to come to bipartisan consensus. If you have a group of experts working on the basis of facts. And so whatever...
In praise of facts.
So whatever it is that we brought in, we recognized that we needed to understand the situation as it was. We needed to forecast from that situation forward. We needed to understand what was happening on the ground and in the policy and make our recommendations on the basis of facts. And that very thing made it possible for six people of different ages, of different genders, of different political parties, and of different experiences actually to work toward a common agreement and a consensus document that I'm very proud of.
And by six, you mean 12?
By six, I mean 12.
Double the fun.
Double the fun.
I'll say two
six
things.
And six.
The first is, this is a challenge, I think, whether you're inside government or outside trying to make a set of recommendations. You can talk and discuss and debate forever. So what you do about Russia and Syria, we could have spent an entire year just on that. What you do about Iran and Syria and how do we understand that problem set, you could spend 2 years just on that. And in the end, we were aware that most readers were probably just going to read the executive summary of the Syria study report.
No.
And you read the whole thing last night.
If that.
It was a very good executive summary.
It was a great executive summary, and Dana was an awesome leader, along with Mike Singh.
Well, thanks. So one is, as a group, when do you decide that you've talked enough? And then when do you just decide what to do? And so on certain things, one of the things we say on the at the top of the report is that this is a consensus document, but not every member agrees with every assertion or every recommendation and conclusion. And I think that's really important. There's just no way that all 12 members were going to endorse everything, every word of the entire document. And I think it is challenging a group dynamic to decide at some point we're not going to agree on an issue. And the issues where we couldn't reach consensus, we didn't include recommendations. And two, I'm just going to say on the gender dynamic, I had a baby 2 days, well, 12 hours after the first 2 days of Syria study group meetings. And so I sort of felt like I experienced the ultimate gender dynamic of trying to, or I aspired to be a regular contributing member of the Syria study group and be present, and at the same time had this massive, huge thing happen in my life. And what I found was an incredibly supportive group of people, provided that I was very honest and open and upfront about exactly what I needed. So the baby came to a lot of our meetings. I think everybody took turns
and
holding
a great contributor.
And
he really added
I know. And also, the three of us were on, half of the group traveled to Lebanon and Turkey, and the three of us were on that trip. And I had to pump breast milk. So I just talked about breast milk on a Bombshell recording.
It's not the first time.
It's not the first or last.
That actually required one night, like in the back of a bus, like Kim holding like a jacket over me while I could pump breast milk with like Ambassador Fred Hoff in the front of the bus. And another time, like Mara holding the door for me in like a stinky bathroom in Lebanon so I could pump breast milk. And or saying in a briefing during the Syria City group, I'm going to be 20 minutes late and I can't, because I have to go take care of this. So talking about my needs and making sure that my colleagues supported me, it was not easy, but it was doable, and I'm proud that I was able to do both and had a supportive group of colleagues.
And can I just commend the men on this group who were equally supportive of this?
They averted their eyes during the pumping.
I mean, it actually normalized a bunch of things, right? We all have stuff going on in our lives, and there are these barriers to entry to acknowledging them. And I found that the baby was a really helpful way to focus, to be able to say, actually, you know what, I can't do X or Y because of this thing happening or what have you. Suddenly, we all remembered that we were people, not just experts.
And maybe that's a good segue for us to, we wanted to save a good amount of time for you all to ask questions here and really... a sort of broad set of questions. I mean, I think, you know, we have experts on Syria, but we also have women with really amazing careers and also lives outside of their expertise. And so I think maybe we'll just stop there and open it up to you all.
So I think there are microphones here and here. I see two set up in the middle. If folks have questions, please go ahead and queue up. Maybe tell us your first name and ask us your question. We will field them and move forward.
I have a lot of questions, especially because you're talking about Syria. As a Syrian person, especially, I find it very interesting, this subject. I have a lot of connections, obviously, to it. A lot of times I hear objectives being focused on the military and on the oil fields. And I feel like a lot of times, too, you ignore Syrian civil society at large. So in what ways can you bridge the communication gap between what is happening on the ground and what is happening at the oversight level? For myself, I come from a human rights background. I did a lot of field reporting in Senegal and Kenya. A lot of it was based on this communication gap when I would meet with grassroots organizations and then meet with regional directors. What I found coming from the survivors and champions to be very different than what was trying to be implemented and what was of concern to the people up here. So in what ways are you bridging that gap, especially in a country like Syria, where I find the cultural understanding of my people, the Syrian people, to be very misunderstood perhaps in this country or just in the West, generally speaking? So thank you.
So I would say, first of all, in general, not unique to Syria, I think there's always a challenge connecting between civil society activists and what like big policy is, especially U.S. This has been a consummate problem or challenge. We were particularly cognizant of that when it came to the Syria Study Group and wanted to reach as many both civil society groups that are working in Syria and also Syrian American organizations based here in the U.S. who would have views or input. So the first thing is, anytime any group or individual contacted the Syria Study Group, we made time for them. So whether it was emails or an in-person meeting or a phone call, if they wanted to be heard by us, we made ourselves heard. I would note here, we were not the U.S. government. We did not represent the U.S. government, and we did not see it as our job to explain U.S. policy to people who were wondering what it was. We, as Mara talked about earlier, were equally perplexed at times by the different perspectives we got from different agencies and departments of the U.S. government about what we're doing in Syria. And two, we actually had an entire day dedicated to listening to Syrians and Syrian Americans. So we invited every single group in. They all had time to make presentations. We had time to ask questions back. And then for our group, when we traveled to the region, we asked U.S. embassy and diplomatic staff to connect us to Syrian civil society groups that were doing various kinds of work inside Syria or across the border. And we wanted to understand what they're doing, how they view the U.S. government, how they view the assistance, and how they experience that assistance. And we have recommendations in the report on all of that.
And I might just add, you know, some of the most illuminating discussions were when we met with the cohort of civil society folks here and then out in the region, because it's really easy, I think, for those of us not in that world to see them all as a unitary actor, which is utterly inaccurate, of course, and to kind of hear them debate and disagree with one another about the parameters and permutations of what was happening and what should be done and what was and was not working was tremendously valuable.
I also want to add another point to this is the vocabulary used often when describing these issues, I think can also be problematic. And I wonder in what ways you are combating certain use of language, for example, the correlation between, or the conflation, I should say, between like Islam and Arab, or conflations between like being Syrian and then being like representative of the Middle East, or like those sort of conflations, or if you touch on that at all.
Thank you.
I think that this expert group really worked hard to make sure that we understood the multiplicity of actors and that we did not actually attribute to any particular ethnic or or national grouping one idea, but rather the diversity of political and human and religious opinions that are reflected in all of Syria. And it's just good practice as an expert to think about the variety of actors.
I mean, this is where we were a little bit spoiled by the composition, to be frank. You know, unlike in government, when you may, you know, be handed an issue set of which you have no background, many of us have graduate degrees in Middle East studies. Many of us have lived in the region, you know, so we sort of know what we know, but importantly, I think know what we don't know and how to try to get those answers.
Thank you.
I think there's another question.
Hi, my name's Sarah. I'm a 24-year active duty service member. I'd like to broaden it a little bit with the release of the Afghanistan papers. There's been a lot of talk about the accountability of leadership in telling the right message back to the American people and to Washington. But with a war that's gone on so long and engagement of our soldiers, service members around the world, one of the things that we need is people to demand good policy. So how do we connect the people of America when we have no draft and there's, you know, it's harder to know and understand what our service members are doing. And as long as the bills keep getting paid, people keep going over to these wars or whatever you want to call them in Syria. So how do we connect American people so that they ask hard questions of our policymakers?
Thank you. And I would say, let me just start on a human level, having spent some time in Afghanistan as a DOD civilian, and maybe Aaron feels the same way. It's just reading those papers is both gutting and unsurprising, like at the same time, right? It like really captures a lived experience of a cohort of relatively junior people who went to Afghanistan, really, you know, served in a variety of capacities and felt a lot of what they experienced there wasn't reflected in briefings to Congress, in the way that metrics and measures were reported, which is like a thing I worked on there. And I think like there's just a real disconnect, not even between the American public, but between a lot of the people serving and doing the work and the way it was discussed by leadership. And I think that's a really important failure of leadership that we need to get comfortable talking about and talking about honestly and figuring out how we deal with it going forward. So I think there's that piece. I think the second piece is, you know, we're in an era of reducing transparency generally in what the military is doing and with a lot of lack of clarity, either intentional or unintentional, on what our strategy and objectives are. And I think it's because everything is so confusing and everything feels so messy. And I think we do need to start as a national security community, as an experts, start sort of being more comfortable talking, not to entirely exclude but or ally the nuances, but to start getting to some of the meat of what's going on and really having those conversations in the same way people might talk about other issues going on in the world. And I think we tend to avoid doing that in with non-national security crowds outside of our sort of, you know, professional circles. And I think we need to do more of it so we normalize some of the discussion.
I'd love to jump in here. I spent 15 months in Afghanistan over the course of 2010 and 2011 as a volunteer working for, I mean, if work is really the right word, volunteering my time as part of the effort in Afghanistan to General Petraeus, who was then commander of the International Security Assistance Force, and then General Allen, who followed him. And in total, I spent about 18 months of time in Afghanistan all as a volunteer. And I bring that up because, of course, I'm very passionate about Afghanistan as an issue, as a problem, and as a national security problem set, and I do, of course, think that we need to talk very much about what happened there, what we can learn, and how to get better. But I am also extremely disappointed in the reporting that we're receiving because it's conflating everything that happened in Afghanistan over 20 years into like one big single block of time and not actually talking about individual leaders and individual moments in time and the way in which our leaders learned, reacted, and tried to fix problems over the course of 20 years. And I think that's just not really an effective way to study human decision making and human leadership. Every leader has a choice, and every leader has a responsibility, and we do learn and evolve as humans over time. And so reporting that treats all of the history of the Afghanistan war or all of the history of the Iraq war as one big single failure to learn and to grow actually mistakes and ignores the extraordinary experiences of leaders and people on the ground who learned, evolved, and changed and tried to make policy better. And isn't that what we're all about, trying to make policy better?
I think a lot of us spent a lot of time trying to make that policy better. And I think the underlying question is, was that a fool's errand? I also spent a lot of time in Afghanistan, the same time as you, but also a little bit the year before. And this is, you know, one of the still most profound challenges in my life, to have been involved in the Afghan surge and to recognize that it failed. And it didn't fail because of me, obviously. I mean, like, I'm, like, really good at my job, but not quite that good at my job. Also, part of my job was campaign metrics and assessments, was teaching Marines on campaign metrics and assessments, was trying to get anyone at ISAF to collect data on anything interesting at all. And not making particularly much progress on that front. I can always find you metrics that show things are getting slightly better or slightly worse, but there's a broader, you know, any of us who cut our teeth on terrorism, irregular warfare, counterinsurgency, know that there are big picture questions of political viability, support amongst the population, the ability to, you know, engage in self-defense that were never met in Afghanistan. The training mission never, in any given year, met its goals. The command never collected data on Afghan-on-Afghan violence, which is still probably the best measure of the underlying nature of the conflict. We never even had data, as many of you have heard me say for years now, on whether or not district governors slept in their district at night. There are fundamental governance pieces that, as a system, we could not grapple with, and yet, to a person, the military recommended that we continued going, USAID continued pouring money, and congressional leadership provided not a great deal of oversight. This is not just a challenge on the defense side of a particular general, although if anybody wants to go chapter and verse on that, we'll find some scotch. This is much more a question of a broad system that allowed us to continue working in Afghanistan year after year, while everyone doing the actual work was like, man, what a Charlie Foxtrot.
Yeah, and let me, I'll close, and then I know we have another question, but I do want to say, I think we can recognize the tremendous effort and good faith effort by leaders, and still say we failed and people made serious mistakes. And I think we've got to, as a community, be okay with saying those two things, holding those two ideas at the same time. That there were leaders who learned, that there were leaders who tried to do better, that there were people who were really working their hearts out to do something, and that fundamentally, we didn't do the things that needed to get done, and that the efforts we had were not the right ones and failed. And I think, we're only going to, as a community, move forward on some of these things with that.
Can I add to that, Lorana? That only happens if we're willing to talk about it.
Yep.
I mean, there's a profound lack of introspection. And I think while for any of us who ever touch these issues, it is exactly as you said, Rada, gutting and unsurprising. You need some sort of introspection. Yep. I mean, it's been interesting. Some of you may know I'm working on this book and what the military's inherited from being at war since 9/11. And so there's been this debate in some of the interviews I've done of could it ever worked? And some folks say, I question the premise. It did work. We did the best we could. Others say, no, it didn't work because, well, we had the wrong leaders, military or civilian. We didn't get the resources. We didn't have the right strategy. And it seems like unless we're willing to really have that deep dive, and I don't mean some tactical or operational lessons learned, frankly, not terribly useful document, which is generally what we've seen on this topic. You know, you've got to be sort of willing to say, actually, there's a multiplicity of reasons why maybe this has been what it's been. Now, what do we do? If we keep saying, let's assess and assess, and yet we don't have metrics that make sense, that's a real problem. Yep. And I'll just close with this great term that my colleague Paula Thornhill pulled together called accountability soup. Mm. And it's effectively, who do you point the finger at here? And going through those documents kind of reminds me, I'm not exactly sure who.
Go ahead. Hi, my name is Elise, and you have talked a little bit about how the gender makeup of your working group had maybe an impact on the process of the working group, such as normalizing accommodations. I was wondering if you noticed any way in which the gender makeup may have impacted the actual substance of the report.
No,
I don't think it did at all.
I don't think so. This is the second commission I've been a part of. The last one was the National Defense Strategy Commission, which had a very different gender makeup, but I think was equally worthwhile and substantive.
Which is basically where you want to be, right? That whatever the debates are, the lines of discussion, where we came to consensus or where we didn't come to consensus didn't have to do with gender or background. It basically was intellectual disagreements or looking at the facts, and while we may agree on the facts, we didn't reach consensus on recommendations about what to do based on those facts. I would say there were no disagreements about the assessment, so the fact base. There were places where we did not achieve consensus on recommendations, and those were left out, and they never broke down on gender lines.
But, and maybe a different way to frame the question is, if women hadn't been included, they'd been explicitly excluded, would we have gotten a totally different report? And I think the answer is maybe, right? I mean, I think the idea is where we want to be is people who are experts and can provide relevant expertise are participating in the discussion sort of appropriately. There are probably experts that you can fill with all men. There are probably sometimes you can fill with more women than men. And we want to kind of be in a space where we're not worried quite as much about that. We're not there yet, I think.
That's I'm sorry.
No, that's it. But
no, that's a great point. I mean, I guess I'm thinking of the specific women, right? So, if you don't have me, Melissa Dalton, and Dana Strull, well, you don't have, 2.5 decades of experience in the Pentagon. If you don't have Kim Kagan, you don't have someone who has lived and breathed these issues for at least 2 decades. If you don't have Ann Patterson, you don't have someone who has wrangled Lord knows how many folks dealing with these issues and thinking about them. So it does feel very different if you don't have those individuals.
Thank you.
Good. Hi, my name is Kelsey. I'm currently a national security consultant for Deloitte, but just finished a counterterrorism fellowship at the University of Texas. So this was a topic that I was really familiar with and interested in during my time in graduate school. But after following some of the release of the Syria study report and then the subsequent decision by the Trump administration, I found it was just frustrating to see that well-researched, well-defended evidence was somewhat ignored by the part of our government that makes a lot of foreign policy decisions. So looking at what you guys found through your Syria study report and your time working on this, what type of impact do you wish the report had that maybe it hasn't so far, other than the very obvious what the Trump administration decided with Syria?
So President Trump's decision was actually the best thing to happen with the Syria Study Group report, because one of the first things we say
to the report, not
in,
to Syria, sorry, to be clear,
not to Syria, to the Syria Study Group report, what one of the first things we say, I think, either in the strategic overview, I think it's in the strategic overview, we talk about the fact that Syria is just not on the radar for most Americans at all. They're not thinking about it. They're not aware about it. And this is a group of people who is following it, but norms of conduct or norms of conflict, like how you fight wars, have been smashed in Syria. The refugee exodus, what's taking place in the effects on the region, the effects on the neighborhood, the shattering of U.S. standing and reputation, all of that, the region is very aware of it. Everyone else is talking about it all the time, and it's not being talked about in this country, and it wasn't being talked about in Washington. So one of the first things we tried to do with the Syria Study Group report is make the case to Americans about why Syria matters. And that was not just directly to Americans, but also to members of Congress to explain to their constituents why Syria matters, why they should have more hearings, why they should do more visits, why they should do more legislating and more speaking and more investigations about what's taking place in Syria and what the U.S. policy is, military, but also, like, not just military. It was very unfortunate is a nice word for what happened, but the Syria Study Group report was essentially thrown in the trash and lit on fire about 48 hours, well, 5 days after we launched it. But what that means is that everybody in Congress started talking about the Syria Study Group report. And so we did one hearing to present the findings to the Senate the week it was released, and then the hearing to the House Foreign Affairs Committee was in October after it was released. And what was fascinating is that you actually had members of Congress who had, at a minimum, read the executive summary and wanted to talk about the report. And there wasn't as much partisan disagreement as I think we expected. And that document remains a roadmap for what bipartisan consensus-driven policy on Syria, and parts of it remain relevant today. And a lot of the longstanding messages of what's at stake, what the strategy is, it's still there, and I think because members of Congress and the American people are struggling with what to do and now are actually relatively better versed in what happened, where the U.S. military was, what the Turkish military is doing, that we had these Syrian Kurdish partners, what it means for them, that we were leaving and now are not leaving but have changed where we are and may not be there. But at least Americans are aware of it at a minimum, and if they want to engage more with it, they have the Syria Study Group report.
So I'll make one point, and then we're going to turn it over to Maggie for the last question, which is, you know, this is not uncommon. I mean, this is maybe a little bit more, the lighting on fire was a little bit more dramatic in public than it might be in other instances. But whether you worked on Afghanistan or broader counterterrorism policy, or you've been a China hand for the last 25 years screaming your head off, you know, or you've tried to change naval procurement of something or another, you know, this is a bumpy road, right? Like, being a national security professional is not, you know, a straightforward, you know, kind of going down the yellow brick road. I mean, it is difficult. It is often, it can be heartbreaking. It can be a challenge. And so figuring out, you know, how you make influence, how you make a mark, not for yourself, but for a particular set of policies, for a particular set of values, a particular set of people, those are all the things that, you know, over a long career, you hope you've maybe done one or two of. But it's a challenge, not just for this particular administration or in this particular moment, but for all of us, I think, who want to do, you know, fact-based analysis and make recommendations and have good people execute. That's more challenging than maybe it should be.
So I also love that most of our other questions, I'm trying to undo this to make it a little easier, are about the subject matter, but this is NatSec Girl Squad, so I'm going to ask what I want to ask. And there are five of you, six if we're including Lauren, and for the sake of this question, let's. And while we all contain multitudes, I think it's safe to say you are each very different people. You have different backgrounds, different personalities. The way you carry yourselves is different. And one of the things we talk about a lot in NatSec Girl Squad, and that I struggle with personally, is that in a field that is so male-dominated and so traditional, there are clear-cut ideas of what it takes to be successful, regardless of your gender, regardless of who you are. And I think it's safe to say there's an idea of what it means to be a woman in this field, and sometimes that means not using the word girl. And people have heard me talk about that quite a bit. But from my perspective, I look at the five of you, as, and Lauren as well, as people who I most certainly look up to and admire, and hope that I see parts of myself in parts of you. But as you look back and ahead on your own careers and lives, you've each done it very much your own way. And was it worth it? And I'm really hoping you're going to say yes.
I mean, do we have time for existential crises on the dais right
now? I mean, like, girl, you do you.
Rod, do you want to start?
Yeah, sure. So I would say, first of all, many people will be hearing this, so you don't know that I'm currently wearing an all sequin shirt on stage, because that's how I roll now. And I think that, like, kind of captures what I would say my approach and sort of best version of advice on this is, which is, like, you do have to kind of be yourself, and you have to be a really good version of you, right? So you can't, like, just phone it in, and you can't, you know, be sloppy, and you need to be prepared, but you don't have to be something you're not. And I think a lot of times, and definitely for me when I was first starting, like, I, you know, was in Afghanistan for 10 months. I am not one of the guys. I've never been one of the guys. Probably not going to fit in with the guys. And, like, it just, you have to kind of get comfortable with that and find your way. I think finding your way is hard. And so I think the thing that I would definitely say is worth it is figuring out what actually works for you. Like, how can you actually relate to people? How can you actually be yourself and do the things you're good at in the space you want to? And, like, be really honest with yourself with that. And I think if you can force yourself to do that as early as you can make yourself do it and sit with it and then reassess it when appropriate, you'll find that there's a space that fits for you and a lane that you can try to sort of push yourself down. And again, it's not all sunshine and puppy dogs, but it is sometimes, you know, sequins and tiaras, and that's okay. And I think, you know, owning that and having that be a part of what your story going forward is sort of the best advice / the way I think I've made it worth it enough for me.
That is spot on. So 1,000% yes, of course it was worth it. I think what I would add to Radha's brilliant comment is, as your place in this world changes, so too do the challenges that you face. So when you're the whippersnapper 26-year-old, it's going to be very different how folks think about you and react to you and all of that than when you're the 35-year-old or the 40-year-old or what have you. And frankly, as the field of national security has grown increasingly diverse, it is heartening to see that there's a whole bunch of different models and that there is no linear path, and you can kind of take your own way, figuring out what does it mean to be kind of my authentic self and someone with integrity.
I certainly had a number of dead ends in my early career. I don't necessarily attribute them to gender, but I do attribute a number of them to life, right? I mean, life is about trying things and failing at them and trying new things and taking risks. And then the first thing I want to encourage all of you to do is to understand what it is that you want to do and why, and continue to make it happen, even if you start by failing. Secondly, to take risks to do that, because there's no safe path forward in life. If you don't take a risk, you will be an ordinary person. And then the third thing that I think is so very important is don't pigeonhole yourself. I would have voted myself, at least likely, of the West Point faculty to go to Iraq, really a year before I found myself in Baghdad at the height of the surge, in really dangerous circumstances. And it was just a whole bunch of risk-taking and coincidence that got me there. The last thing I want to say is you need to find a place where you can start out, where your employer values you, And that's one of the things that I love doing at the Institute for the Study of War, and one of the reasons why I'm so proud that we have been 50% female and 50% male for the 13 years of our existence. We can do this because women and men have the same capability and the same aptitude for national security issues.
Dana.
How to follow all these great comments. So I will say I've been a long time sufferer from imposter syndrome. You're all probably familiar with the term. When I got to grad school, I assumed everybody was writing better papers than I was writing. When I got to the Pentagon, I assumed that the people in uniform with stars and birds on their shoulders knew much more than I did. So what could I possibly contribute? When I got to the U.S. Congress, I figured the people who were actually elected to serve in Congress knew more about politics or policy than I did, so what was I going to contribute? And then I got to the think tank worlds and thought, well, all these people have been longtime experts on their very particular expertise. Again, what am I going to contribute here? And it turns out in every single one of those places that I've been for my career, that I definitely had things to say. No one knows the answers, and everyone's basically fumbling around in the dark. So if you really, really listen to what people are saying around the table or at the events, it's very rare that I find something truly unique or new or insightful that I haven't heard. It's just recycled from somewhere else before, which is great for me because... But anyway, point being, have confidence in yourself, have confidence in your views. You're reading or listening to the same things everybody else is, and how you interpret that or what you think about it or what you want to recommend based on that is valuable and is value added, so have confidence in it.
So I don't suffer from imposter syndrome, as those of you who know me are aware, and I am pretty good at being one of the boys. I like these things called sports and the Star Wars and the other things and the movie quotes and the not. And so that also, you know, contributes to the fact that I'm just a giant pain in the ass. I mean, I am an impossible employee in a great many ways, and a challenging boss as well. So all of which is to say, if you're this kind of person, you just got to own that. Like, it's not really that easy to sand off the edges. It's not easy to kind of, you know, these cheekbones are as sharp as they're going to be. They're not going anywhere. So. You have to both own that in terms of your own personality and understand that you are going to have a bumpy road, but you also have to think about how can you use sort of your willingness to Kool-Aid man through a wall to other people's benefit, right? So it's not just about you causing havoc. It's not just you being a pain because you can and because you, like, engage your mouth 10 seconds before your brain all of the time, but that you actually might be able to use your, you know, zero forks, you know, mindset to clear the way for some other folks, and that you're willing to be the first one through the wall, and that sometimes pays some dividends, and at least it doesn't really help the bruises heal any faster, but it makes you feel like they might have been worth it. So I think with that, that is the end of our segment here. Thank you guys so much for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of the conference.